Good morning. Hope you are doing well. And I love it. I love Child Dedication Sundays. It's kind of chaos, and it's wonderful chaos, right? This is week number 3 of a series that we are calling Just Saying, where we're looking at some of the tough stuff that Jesus said. So we've taken 4 passages that a lot of times people read and they're like, man, this is confusing and I don't understand. And sometimes maybe kind of makes you want to give up reading scripture or trying to figure out what it says or what it means. And we're tackling these passages. The way that we have said that is that Jesus said things that are both troubling and true. Now you got a listening guide whenever you came in. That's the first thing if you want to jot some notes down as we go this morning. So kind of what we've done every week is that I've read the passage to you, and then we have interviewed the biblical scholars around here, right? We call them the experts, and we've asked them what they think the passage means. So we're going to do that again today. I'm going to read you the text from Luke chapter 12, and then you can watch the screens and see what the experts have to say about it. Jesus said, I came to cast fire on the earth and would that it were already kindled. I have a baptism to be baptized with, and how great is my distress until it is accomplished. Do you think that I have come to give peace on earth? No, but I tell you rather division. From now on in one house there will be 5 divided, 3 against 2 and 2 against 3. They will be divided, father against son and son against father, mother against daughter and daughter against mother, mother-in-law against her daughter-in-law and her daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. Watch the screens with me.
I don't even know what you said, but yeah, it's true that he says that.
Divided by, I don't know.
They might have consequences and stuff with between each other, and when they grow up, they're not gonna want to be with anybody. They're just gonna wanna be with their friends.
Well, Lincoln and I usually fight a lot.
Yeah, I kind of fight with Ryan.
I was going to sleep with my bear named Barry, and Lincoln was going to, and we were pulling on him.
I just do something. I just carry on with my day, and then he just says I'm annoying.
But I let go, and that was letting him down onto his bottom.
Well, the other day we fought about candy at this Halloween party we went to.
What do you mean, like a talk fight or like wrestle?
We both fight over the remote.
Katie wants to watch TV show that she likes, and then Will wants to watch TV show that he likes.
I'm watching the TV, and she's like, Sissy, watch me! And I'm like, I'm doing something right here.
Sissy's not answering my gymnastics questions. I'm like,
well, to my brother, he was going to throw me into an active volcano. And then I started crying, so.
So there it is. When Jesus says, I came to cast fire on the earth, it's going to divide families. Avoid the active volcano and you'll be in good shape, right? You'll be in good shape. As we look at the text today, I was just reminded this week, do you have people in your life that that when they speak, they have no filter? They just say, whatever's here comes out right here. Like, don't point at the person next to you. You don't have to elbow anybody or point the section over or anything. But I wonder if the disciples felt this way about Jesus sometimes. That there were times when Jesus said things and you're like, oh, you can't. You can't say that. And this is one of those moments in Jesus' life. And here's what I think we've got today. I think we have a very specific Hebrew context with a very specific, oddly enough, American application for us. When Jesus talks about casting fire to the earth, I think the Hebrew context, I think what the Hebrew reader, the Hebrew hearer would have understood, they immediately would have gone back to the Old Testament book of 1 Kings. When you get back to 1 Kings chapter 18, 1 Kings chapter 19, what you realize there have been 20 kings since King David has passed away. Sequentially, all 20 of them have gotten worse and worse and worse, more evil over time. King number 20 is a guy named Ahab and his wife is Jezebel. When I was a kid, if you wanted to say that a lady was a mean lady, you called her How many of you have named your daughters Jezebel, right? Nobody uses that name because it's got this negative connotation. She was from Sidon. It was a politically arranged marriage. But the big thing that Jezebel did is that she brought back the one of the skies, the god Baal and the Asherah. Baal was the god of the sun, the god of the skies, the god of weather. Asherah was the goddess of fertility, the goddess of sexuality. So to the Hebrews, they represented, Baal represented that we need rain for our crops. So that was going to make their crops better. We need more children because that's going to bring us more security and more help in our family. So they prayed to the Asherah. And so in that context, they turn people's hearts away from Jehovah God. And so what God does is he brings a prophet onto the scene, a guy named Elijah. And through Elijah, God says to all of Israel, it's not going to rain until I say it's going to rain. And you think, well, wait a minute, isn't that God maybe punishing everybody just for the, but think about it. When God says it's not going to rain until I say it's going to rain, that's a direct assault on Baal's power. They look to Baal to bring the weather, to bring the rains, to make their crops grow. So after 3 years of this, the Ahab and Jezebel, they hated Elijah. I mean, they hated Elijah. And God orchestrates the circumstances such that Elijah and Ahab, they run into each other. They meet and they have this conversation with one another. This kind of a my God's stronger than your God conversation. And finally, what Elijah says is, okay, let's have a contest. That's what we're going to do. So if you turn back to 1 Kings chapter 19 and verse 19, Elijah says this, now therefore send, gather all Israel to me at Mount Carmel, the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of the Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table. Here's what Elijah says. We're going to go up to the top of Mount Carmel. I'll show you a picture of Mount Carmel and you'll see why Elijah wanted to go there. They were going to go up to the top of this mountain. All of Israel could see them. Elijah says, we're going to set up two sacrifices, one to Baal and Asherah, one to Jehovah. You take 850 prophets of Baal and Asherah. They're going to pray. We'll see if Baal answers by fire. Then I'm going to pray and we'll see if Jehovah answers by fire. The God who answers by fire, the real, like most competitions between boys, there's fire involved, right? And so he says, whichever God answers by fire, that's the real God. Now, the question, I guess, for us is why? Why does Elijah set this up? Here's what he says in verse 21. And Elijah came near to all the people and said, how long will you go limping between two different opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him. And the people did not answer him a word. So here's what Elijah says to the people. He says, look, how long are you going to vacillate back and forth? If God's God, worship him. If Jehovah's your God, worship him. If not, go worship the Baal and the Asherah. But don't try and be in the middle. Don't try and limp along, he says, between the two. What Elijah's trying to point out is that when it comes to worship, there is no legitimate third option. There's either you're going to worship Jehovah, the God of the heavens, or you're going to worship Baal and the Asherah, but you can't have both. Now, that is very current in our world. That applies to us very well. In our culture, it is very, very relevant to say, well, listen, you can worship your God, and you can worship your God, and you can worship your God, and all the gods and all the religions, they kind of just go, and they kind of lead to the same place anyway. Elijah would say, no, that's not the case. One of my favorite teachers is a guy named Ravi Zacharias, and about 20 years or so ago now, he was teaching on the West Coast, and the guy who was hosting him set up a lunch for he and an ethics professor, I believe the professor was from Berkeley, if I'm not mistaken, to have lunch together. So they sit down to lunch, and the professor of ethics says to Dr. Zacharias, you know, I've read one of your books, I've listened to some of your lectures, and I think I've found a part of your thinking that I want to talk to you about. And Ravi Zacharias certainly says, okay, and he starts eating. I think if I remember the story correctly, Ravi said he was eating spaghetti. So he starts eating spaghetti, and the ethics professor sitting across from him doesn't touch his food. He just starts in and he starts talking. And he said, what I see is the difference, Dr. Zacharias, that maybe you don't see, is he said, you teach in a Western mindset. That's us, right? We're the West. He said, you teach in a Western mindset. And the Western mindset is either or. Either A is true, or B is true, but both A and B cannot be true. He said, that's the way the Western mind works. Do you see that, Dr. Zacharias? And he's just eating his spaghetti. He's like, mm-hmm. And he said, what you need to understand, Dr. Zacharias, is you need to understand the Eastern mindset. Now, never mind that Ravi Zacharias was born and grew up in India, right? He's like, but you need to understand the Eastern mindset. The Eastern mindset is not either or. It's both and. So both A is true and B is true. See, it's both and, Dr. Zacharias, not either or. Do you understand the difference between the two? Does that make sense to you? Maybe that's the flaw there. And for the first time, he reached down to take a bite of his food, and Dr. Zacharias put his spaghetti fork down, and he said, so let me just ask you a question. What you're saying to me is either your way of thinking A and B are true is correct, or I'm wrong. Is that what you're saying? And the ethics professor kind of sat up, and he's like, there are moments where the either or does seem to win out, aren't there? And see, there's something inside of us that says, well, we can just worship, and we can worship, and all gods kind of go to the same place, and there's multiple gods, and that's Elijah says there is no legitimate third option. What the Hebrews had done is they had set up false gods for themselves that were designed to give them what they wanted, to give their lives comfort. That's really what they had designed. They worshiped Baal because Baal would give them more crops. They worshiped the Asherah because the Asherah would give them more children, more kids. I'll drop a couple of seminary words on you, monotheism and polytheism. See, the Hebrews, what made them distinct in their part of the world is that they were monotheists. They worshiped one God, Jehovah. All of the other nations around them were polytheists. They worshiped many gods. But with the Hebrews, what they were trying to do is they had monotheistic beliefs, but polytheistic behaviors. So on the Sabbath day, they would go to the synagogue and they would say, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. They would quote the Shema, right? But when they would go out and they would live the next day, they would worship multiple gods. Why did they do that? They did that because of the promise of false gods. False gods promise what only the true God provides. See, there's nothing wrong with wanting or even praying for better crops. There's nothing wrong with praying for more kids or wanting more kids. You just can't turn good things into God things. That's what they had done. False gods promise what only the real God provides for us. So think about it this way. Money in our culture, money is a very popular God, very popular false God. Why do we worship money? We do that because money promises us that it gives us security and power and control. But how many people do you know that are very well off financially, that have more than enough financial means, but they go to the doctor and they get a diagnosis of cancer or some other terminal illness? And all of a sudden you realize false God's promise, what only the real God provides. False gods are designed to give us security. And I know what we think. We think, well, sure, Dean, but those people that lived thousands and thousands of years ago, we're smarter than they are today. We know more. I think C.S. Lewis called that chronological snobbery. When we think we're so much more intelligent than the people were. I'll give you an example. It comes right out of the text. You know, whenever they worshiped the Asherah, you know what they did? The Asherah was a pole that was set up in places in Israel. And when they went to worship the Asherah, a priestess, a lady, would come out. She would dance around the pole seductively. She was the goddess of sexuality, and they would make an offering to her. Now think about that for a minute. Women dancing seductively around poles, and we give money to them. We're so much smarter than they were, right? We would never do anything like that in our culture. We're just the same as they were, and our hearts are just as dislocated and misaligned as their hearts were in their culture. It's the same. So Elijah says, you guys go pray. You start the prayer off in the morning. And they did. Here's how the narrative goes. And they being the prophets of Baal and Asherah, took the bull that was given to them. They prepared it. They called upon the name of Baal from morning until noon, saying, "O Baal, answer us." But there was no voice. You know, the thing that is characteristic of false gods, there's no voice. No one answered. And they limped around the altar they had made, and at noon, Elijah mocked them, saying, "Cry aloud, for he is a god. Either he is musing, or he is relieving himself, or he is on a journey, or perhaps he has fallen asleep and must be awakened." And they cried aloud and cut themselves after the custom with swords and lances until the blood gushed out upon them. And as midday passed, they raved on until the time of the offering of oblation. But there was no voice. No one answered. No one paid attention. What I love about this is Elijah's talking prophet smack, right? This is better than any NBA game that you'll ever watch. Elijah's like, hey, I don't think you're praying loud enough. He's a god, right? I mean, certainly, maybe he's hard of hearing. He can't hear you. Maybe he's on a trip. Maybe he's asleep. Maybe you need to, you know, yell a little louder. Maybe he's relieving. Maybe he's in the bathroom. That's what he says. He's relieving himself. Maybe he's in the bathroom, and so he's busy. You need to call him out of the bathroom. And they yell and they yell and they yell, and there's no voice and there's no answer. So they cut themselves. The text says, till the blood gushes on them, trying to get Baal's attention. Nothing happens. So here's what Elijah says in verse 37. "Answer me, O Lord, answer me, that this people may know that you, O Lord, are God, and that you have turned their hearts back. Then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering. And when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and they said, 'The Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God.'" Now look, Elijah goes up there, and I didn't read all the text, but the text says that he douses his sacrifice with water before he prays, just to make sure. He wants the people to make sure they know that this is God. And God casts fire down from heaven and it eats up the sacrifice. Now, I know a lot of us struggle with the miraculous events in the scriptures, the Bible. But look, if God is the one who created the world, it is nothing to him to suspend the natural order of the way things work periodically. That is no big deal for God. Some of you sit in this room today, you understand, you've prayed for a miracle and you've gotten it. You've seen the miracle and you felt it, and you know what that's like. And at the same time, I'll say to you, that is inspiring. And listen, I love when God answers miraculously. I hope you've prayed it and you've seen it. I love that. But as inspired as I am by the miracle, I'm almost more inspired by the people who pray for the miracle and don't get the answer that they want, but they keep walking in faithfulness. Now, I was blessed to be part of praying with Phil and Tara that Mark talked to you about when she struggled with infertility and wasn't able to have children. And we prayed and we prayed and we prayed and we prayed what felt like a long time. And then God answers, right? And she gets pregnant, and we were part of that miracle. But how many times are there people and their husbands and their wives who pray and pray and pray, and they ask and they ask and they ask, and they don't receive the miracle? But they continue to walk in faithfulness. They continue to trust God. That almost inspires me more than even the miracles themselves do. If you've been around here very much, you know that in the last couple of months, we've done a number of funerals, probably more funerals in the last couple of months than we've done in our previous 10 to 13 years probably of doing funerals than we have combined. And in doing funerals, I've just been reminded over the last couple of months that I have the privilege, the blessing to be part of, for lack of a better way to say it, sacred moments. I was blessed a few weeks ago to do the funeral of Pastor John Kirby. He's a retired pastor. He pastored a church over here on Mays Road down in Columbus for over two decades. And Pastor John and his wife, Sylvia, they were mentors to me in college, so kind to me. And after he retired, they came here to be part of our church and part of our church family. And so I get to be part of these moments sometimes in funerals that I don't know any other way to say it. Because what will happen at times in a funeral, if the casket is left open, and Pastor John and Sylvia, they were married 54 years. 54 years. They ran off and got married when he was 18 and she was 16, which I do not advocate if my children are in the room. But they were married 54 wonderful years through a lot of thin times. They followed the Lord. And so what happens at a funeral, if the casket's open typically, is the funeral will end and the funeral director comes forward. He releases everyone to go to their cars if you're going to the cemetery, and everybody walks out and the family kind of hangs around for a few minutes. And even the family members, extended family, will start to trickle off just a little bit, and I kind of tend to stay with the family and be there. And that moment that, it, to me, is so sacred is when you watch that spouse lean over that casket for the last time, 54 years. And they plant one more kiss on that forehead and one more pat on that shoulder. And listen, that's not Pastor John. He's long gone to be absent from the body, he's present with the Lord. I know that, but that's the shell, right? That she loved. And watch that last moment, and it's awful, and it's horrible, and it's wonderful, and it's incredible. And I find myself saying, Lord, give me that kind of love and that kind of passion. Give me that. You see, knowing God personally. See, Pastor, I mean, God could have healed Pastor John, right? He had a 13-year battle with a disease called amyloidosis. It was awful. They only gave him about a year and a half to live when he was diagnosed, and he lived for 13. And God could have healed him physically, but instead God chose to heal him ultimately. And watching him walk through that was such an encouragement and an inspiration to me. So here's where that brings us to this narrative today. When you move forward from Elijah to Jesus in Luke chapter 9, Jesus carries the disciples walks with the disciples into a village, and the village rejects Jesus. Jesus is ready to teach, and they said, no, we're good. We don't want you here. And so the disciples come to Jesus, and they say, well, Jesus, what do you want us to do? You want us to pray and ask God to cast fire down from heaven, a la Elijah? That's what the Hebrew reader would have thought, a la Elijah in the Old Testament. We'll pray, and God will cast fire. He'll destroy this village. And Jesus kind of looks at the disciples almost frustrated in Luke chapter 9. He's like, no, just kick the dust off the sandals of your feet, and we're gonna move on. We're going to go on. And it's a few chapters later where I think Jesus, he unpacks with the disciples what they've just been through and what they've seen. And that's the verses that I read to you in Luke chapter 12 earlier, but I'm gonna read just a portion of those to you again from chapter 12, verses 49 and 50. Jesus says, I came to cast fire on the earth, and would that it were already kindled. I have a baptism to be baptized with, and how great is my distress until it is accomplished. Why does Jesus say, I came to cast fire on the earth, and it's a fire that's gonna divide families? Here's what I think Jesus means by that. I think Jesus has a very healthy understanding of the reality of the gospel. Now remember, we talk about the gospel, we talk about it in two parts. And there's one part that we love. We love the Jesus coming, giving his life for us, God's grace, God's mercy poured out on us. We love that part. But the first part of the gospel is that you and I have to understand, and we have to believe, and we have to be committed to the reality that we are sinners, not just sinners by choice, but we're sinners by nature. That means we are born with our hearts turned away from God and towards ourselves. So what does that mean? That means for me to be a Christian, I have to believe that it takes just as much of Jesus' sacrifice, just as much of Jesus' blood to save me as it does to save Jeffrey Dahmer or Ted Bundy. We have the same nature. Have we committed different sins? Yes. Are there different consequences? Yes. Will they be judged differently? I don't know. I'm not the judge. One of the wonderful things about the gospel is that I don't have to be the judge. I let God be the judge, and I let God reason and ration all of that out in the end. But I do have to be committed to the reality that without Christ, I am absolutely hopeless, just as hopeless as anyone else who's ever done any other thing. And you need to be just as committed to that truth if you're gonna call yourself a Christian.
All right.
The gospel requires an incredible level of humility. And here's what I think. I think Jesus knew that not all of us would be willing to embrace that level of humility. And so what that means is that there were gonna be families that are gonna be divided. Some of the family is gonna be committed to that level of humility and receive Christ and understand where they are, and some are not. That's one of the things I love about a day to dedicate all these families and all these children. I love to see mom and dad come together, bring that child together and say, God, we're putting this child back in your hands, right? They're not ours or yours. We're gonna do our best to point them back your direction. You're gonna lead them and we're gonna do everything we can to pour into them. And I would just say, if you're here today and you're one of the families that was up here, continue pursuing Christ together. Don't let one of you just be the leader out there, nudging everybody, making everybody go to church, reminding everybody, dragging everybody. Because unfortunately, I could spend all morning here running people across this stage, one after another, who even though they are married, feel like they're carrying the ball spiritually for their family. And even though they're married, they feel incredibly alone. They feel like it's all riding on their shoulders. So mom and dad, if you're here this morning, don't let your house be divided. You pursue Christ together. And I know some of you may be here today and you may be like, well, Dean, that's kind of me. Like, I just come because my wife wants me to come, or I just come because my spouse wants me to come, and that's why I'm here. There's an incredible opportunity. You have the same opportunity to pursue Christ as your spouse does. Take it. Wrap your life around it, your heart around it. Take it. But I also understand that if you're the one who's here and you're the one who's leading and you're the one who's trying to help your family come to know Christ and point them in the direction, that you know what it's like to hear your spouse say, what happened to the old you? As you're growing and as your faith is taking, what happened? I want the old you. I want the one that partied back. I want the one that blah, blah, blah back. I want the one that blah. What is up with this new you? And you can be married and feel very alone. So let me also say, if you're here today and you're single, do not compromise. You can compromise in a lot of ways. Do not compromise in this area of your life. Marry someone who matches your pursuit of Christ. Not just somebody who calls himself a Christian, but who matches your pursuit of Christ. Because if you don't, it's going to be very difficult. You're going to be house divided at some point if you are really a Christian. And you're going to know the weight and the difficulty of what that is. We have families who are here today. You know this reality. Thanksgiving's coming, Christmas is coming, and you're already thinking about it. How are we gonna navigate this when our bigger family gets together? How are we gonna do this? Because you get the snide remarks, and you get the sarcasm, and you get the, oh, you're better than everybody else, and you get the, you're too good for us, right? You get all those little reminders, the eye rolls that come, you know, with you understand, you feel the sting and the burn of that. Some of you feel the separation that comes because you've made choices in your family, and it's caused a gap. It's created a division and separation. If you're here today and you're a high school student, you're a college student, listen to me. Date integrity over beauty. Date faithfulness over loveliness. Because the people you date set the field for the person that you're eventually going to marry. Jesus said, I came to cast fire onto the earth. And when he said that, and I think his hearers hearken back to Elijah, I think Jesus is making a very specific point. I think what he's saying to the disciples is, listen, I'm not here to call fire down from heaven on this village. Do you not understand? I'm not Elijah calling fire down from heaven. No, 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 no. I'm the sacrifice that gets burned up. Just like Elijah goes up onto that hill, at the end of his life, Jesus goes up onto a hill called Calvary. And just like the fire of God falls on that hill, the fire of God's anger, his wrath against sin, instead of it falling on you and me, it fell on Jesus. That's why he said, I have a baptism to be baptized with. So what happens is, instead of Jesus bringing the fire of God's judgment, Jesus actually receives the fire of God's judgment for you and for me in your place and in my place. You're like, okay, I understand the reality, but so what? So what? So there is no third option. There is no other God. There is no other one who has come and who has sacrificed himself for you. As a matter of fact, it's just the opposite. Whatever it is that you call God, other people's approval, whether it's money or whether it's beauty or whether it's sexuality or power or career, whatever it is, that God is gonna say to you, bleed for me, perform for me, yell to me, We have the only God. Christians have the only God who says, I will bleed for you, and I will pray for you, and I will come for you. So listen, I don't know how you got here today. I don't know, somebody invited you. I don't know if you drove by and saw the sign and this is the first time you've ever been in church or the first time you've been in church for years. But here's what I do know, that the sacrifice and the grace of God is so big for you that he was willing to give his one and only son on a cross to die in your place. And no matter where you are today, no matter what you've done, no matter if you think it was awful, and if you stay in here much longer, like the roof's gonna cave in, like you haven't been in church, and you think, man, these people don't know what I've done. And listen, I know most of the people, or a lot of the people in the room, I know what they've done. It's probably worse than what you've done, okay? But let me also say, if you're here today and you think, you know what, I'm a pretty good person, I really don't, you're the same person. And we all need Christ. So this is your chance. This is your opportunity right now. So what I'm gonna do in just a second is I'm gonna pray. And you can pray with me if you want to take that step today of confessing your sin, not just your choices, but your nature. And saying, God, I'm done trying to be a third option person. I wanna only be yours. I want you to be in charge of my life. I don't know the future. I don't know what that means, but whatever it means, I'm yours. If you'd like to take that step today, I'd love to help you right now. Let's pray. Father, I pray for folks who are here today and you've nudged them, you've brought them, you've drawn them to this space in this moment. God, I pray that they'll have the courage to follow you. If that's you, as we continue to pray, you can just pray something like this. Dear Jesus, thank you for dying for me on the cross. Thank you for paying for my sins. Please forgive me of my sins. Make my heart new. And today, Jesus, I'm saying I don't want to follow other gods. I only want to follow you. I want you to be in charge of my life. Thank you for this salvation gift. As we just kind of stay in that attitude of prayer, nobody's looking around the room, I'm going to ask that you would give me the privilege and the honor of being the first person that you tell that you've taking that step just by raising your hand right now. Nobody's gonna point at you or ask you to give a speech. But would you do that if you prayed with me? Just slip your hand up and say, yeah, that was me today. Thank you, way in the back, thanks. Just by lifting your hand, saying, yeah, that was me, the way to seal it up, thank you, great, awesome. Lord, we see you on the cross and it is awful and it is terrible. And it is wonderful, and it is incredible. The salvation that you shed your blood for us. And I pray, God, that we will give our lives to you the way that you have given your life to us. It's in your name we pray, amen.